thank you for taking the time to listen to this life-changing message from the Ministry of Faith Bible Chapel. We hope this message will encourage you in all parts of your life. At the end of this message, you will hear more information on how to contact our church family, as well as directions for you to visit us for any of our worship services. Until then, join us for the service in progress.
Open up your Bibles to Matthew chapter 9, verse 9. We're going to walk through this idea of Jesus encountering an ordinary person doing an ordinary job who transforms him because of this encounter. But I want to tell some backstory to what's been happening before Jesus walks up to Matthew. You see, Matthew was just doing his job, but prior to that, prior to this encounter, Jesus is ministering and he's teaching and he's gathering a following and he's moving all throughout the land of Israel and ministering to people. He's healing people. He's saying new things about what God would say to his people. And I'm going to back us up to chapter 8 for a little bit. We see this story in chapter 8, verse 5, where Jesus enters Capernaum. I want to show you a map of Israel real quick on the screen. I want to show you where Capernaum is because it's important to the story. You can see this map of Israel. And if I can get my pointer on for you guys, let me see if I can get this thing to work. We tested it. It's not up there. My bad. If you look on the northern part of the land of Israel, you'll see that there's a small lake. It's called the Lake Kinneret, or the Sea of Galilee. There's the Red Sea down below. This is the land of Israel. So in this moment, when we find Matthew, he's ministering up in the Sea of Galilee area. So you can go ahead and move to the map of the Sea of Galilee. We're going to focus in on that sea area. Up on the northwest portion of the Sea of Galilee is Capernaum. So this is where we find Jesus, and we can leave the map up there. We find Jesus enters Capernaum, and a centurion comes to him, a Roman guard, and says, "My servant is paralyzed and is feeling terrible and needs a healing." And Jesus says, "I will come." And the centurion says, "You don't need to come. You speak of authority. You can heal from where you're at." And the famous story of Jesus saying, "This man has greater faith than anyone in Israel," happens right there in Capernaum, between Jesus and a Roman soldier. The servant is healed, and everyone's amazed. Jesus then makes his way further into Capernaum, into Peter's house, and he heals someone there. So he's moving around the city of Capernaum doing healing. Let me show you a picture of Capernaum in modern-day times. I've had a chance to be there one time. This is the remains of the city. You can see that white structure is a 4th-century synagogue. That would mean that was built somewhere in the years 300s. You can see the little town underneath where there would be walls and bricks and houses. You can stand today in Capernaum and imagine Jesus literally walking the streets. You see, it was a sea fishing village, but it was a cultural center as well, and I'll talk about that in a few moments. Underneath that sort of white-colored building, the 4th-century synagogue, they found pavement that dates back to a 1st-century synagogue in front of a pavement that literally, in this place in the Sea of Galilee, you can stand where Jesus ministered, where he spoke to centurions, where he went to Peter's house and healed. You can imagine life happening in this seaside village. So Jesus is ministering in Capernaum, and what he does, he crosses, all sorts of crowds gather around him, and he begins to back away, and he decides to cross across the other side of the lake. So I'll show you the map of Galilee again. You'll see he crosses from the northwest side in Capernaum, and he goes down to the southeast side. And we find while he's crossing on this boat with the disciples, a storm rises up. It's a famous story of Jesus calming the storm. He's literally with real people in a real storm, and he speaks authority over the storm. He goes to the other side, the southeast side of the Sea of Galilee. He finds 2 demon-possessed men, and he casts the demons out of them into pigs. And if you know the story, you know it well. That's where that happened, on the southeast side of the Sea of Galilee. It then says in chapter 9 that Jesus steps in a boat and crosses back over to his hometown, Capernaum. So when we pick up Matthew, we pick up this story of Jesus ministering all around the Galilee, all around the Sea of Galilee, Capernaum and the other sides of the Sea of Galilee. So when we find Matthew in chapter 9, verse 9, it says this: "And Jesus went from there. He saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth." Let me unpack this a little bit for us today. The tax collector's booth. You see, when Rome would conquer a land, one of the ways they'd conquer it would be to have authority over it and then collect taxes from the native people that they conquered. And they would establish a process to do this. In fact, it would be like a government contract. They would go to the people that they've conquered and say, who would like to bid on being our tax collectors? And if you won the bid, you got to run the racket of tax collecting from your own people. And we know Matthew is a tax collector, but he didn't win the bid. It doesn't refer to him as the chief tax collector. You see, Zacchaeus, we're familiar with the story of Zacchaeus. He's known as a chief tax collector. You see, Rome set up three tax districts, one in Capernaum in the Galilee area, one in Caesarea by the sea, which is further down the Mediterranean coast to the south and to the west, and then one around Jerusalem and Jericho. So we know there's these three tax districts, and there would be a head of each tax district. That would be Zacchaeus in one of those, not this one. Zacchaeus was located in Jericho. But Matthew would be sitting there tax collecting. And if you know anything about tax collecting in those days, you were free to extort, I should say, from the people. That the Roman Empire didn't care how much more you took for yourself as a prophet. All they cared that you gave them every year the assigned amount of taxes from that region of land. So you see, someone like Zacchaeus, that was the chief tax collector, he could be wealthy and manage this system of extortion. And he wouldn't have to do all the hard, dirty work of tax collecting. But someone like Matthew, sitting in the tax collector's booth, he had to shake up people as they walked by. He had to get in their faces and force them to give him money. He had to sit there and do the dirty work of tax collecting. It's kind of like white-collar crime. And this is why Matthew and other tax collectors were seen as extortionists, as sinners, as folks we didn't want to hang around, because they were Jews who had traded on their own people to extort their own people for the sake of honoring Rome. You see, Matthew had to sit there as a tax collector and extort from his own people. But let me explain where this booth was. This booth was located on a major trade route. You see, Capernaum was not just a sea fishing village, but it was a cultural center of Greek and Hellenistic ideology. And so people traveling from Damascus would take the international highway. The Damascus would be up to the northwest. They'd come through the Sea of Galilee area, through Capernaum, off to the Mediterranean coast, and could travel all the way down south to Egypt. So coming through Capernaum meant you're going to have to face the city center. You're going to have to pay the taxes. You're going to have to be roughed up by people like Matthew. Well, for me, as I unpack this story, I think about any time I pass by a toll booth. Very few of us get to do that around here in Denver. There's not many toll booths, but I think of at DIA, and when you come out of the parking lot, you've got to pass by a toll booth, and you've got to pay, and it slows you down. Well, some folks get grumpy at that because it slows you down, but I kind of like the experience. I like to say hi to the person, ask them how they're doing. You know, you can go to the credit card only station, or you can go where there's a person. I like to go to the one where there's a person and interact with them a bit before I pull away. It's a fine experience. Well, I used to work with a person who spent a lot of time in New Jersey, and they said the New Jersey Turnpike and the toll booths are so entirely different that people get so tired of toll booths that they just chuck their money in the basket angrily. Is this true? Has anyone experienced this? I found this to be true on a trip a number of years ago. My wife and I and three other couples, we were traveling to New York City. We spent some time in New York City, and then we wanted to go travel down to the Jersey Shore and spend some time down there. So after spending the time in New York City, we went back to the New Jersey airport and rented a van together. We got a 12-passenger van for the 12 of us, and we thought, you know what? Before we go to the shore, let's go to IKEA. You see, this was the days before Colorado had an IKEA, and we all wanted to go see this IKEA. And it was 4 miles from the airport, and we knew we had a couple-hour drive, but let's just stop by IKEA, have some cheap Swedish meatballs, and we'll be on our way to the Jersey Shore. So we pull out from the airport, and there's eight of us, and we've got our maps and our iPhones, and we're tracking to how to get to IKEA. And we go past the first toll booth, and we think, okay, well, good thing our driver, who was very organized, had got a lot of change for all the tolls in New Jersey. And so we paid the toll happily, and we're excited. We're about to head to IKEA. Well, there's a few of us trying to lead the directions, and we ended up making a wrong turn. And so we got a little bit lost, and instead of taking 15 minutes, now it's taken a half an hour. And we can reorient ourselves and get to IKEA. But we miss a turn, and we end up entering onto the highway, and we end up driving right past the IKEA, kind of waving at it as we miss the turn. And we're starting to get a little irritated because we're all competent people with maps, but we're not finding our way to the IKEA. So we end up having to exit the highway and go back past the exact same toll booth. So we pay the same toll again, and we move on, and we focus, and we think we're going to get there. Well, you've heard the phrase, there's too many cooks in the kitchen. Well, there's too many leaders in our minivan, because all of us were trying to lead and serve at the same time. Well, the story goes, and you may not believe this, but we continued to make the same mistakes over and over and over and over. We drove by IKEA at least 6 times, missing the turnoff every time. We passed by that same toll booth at least 6 times, paying multiple toll booths all over the city of this area of New Jersey. It took us 2.5 hours to get to IKEA, and those of us that were in the car being driven, once we had set our mind to it, we weren't going to miss it. So we're 2.5 hours into our drive, and by the time we pass that toll booth the last time, we do not care who's there. We do not care what attitude we show them. We are ignorant of their reality and their world, and we are just chucking our money at them in anger and frustration with each other that we can't find this IKEA. For goodness sakes, all we want is cheap Swedish meatballs. So we get to the IKEA. We let out a cheer because we did make it. We were not going to be denied. And then we got out of the van very quiet. And we walked up, and it was closing. It was like 9 o'clock, and we ate almost in silence for fear that we would chew each other out and end what was going to be a glorious 3 or 4 days at the Jersey Shore. You see, when life happens, and you're at a tax collector's booth or a toll booth, as this would be, you get ignored. The people that drive by don't see you. They're frustrated that you have to do the dirty work of taking money from them for passing down this road. You see, when Jesus went from there in Capernaum, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at the tax collector's booth. He took notice. He walked across the room. He was willing to say something to someone that no one would say something to. You know, I picture the first century when a family's on vacation from Damascus to the Mediterranean, and dad's pulling the donkey, and the kids are in the back saying, "Why aren't we there yet?" And dad says to mom, I thought we bought those ice rolls to keep them entertained on this road trip." And mom's got like donkey sickness because you keep changing lanes around the camel caravans. Dad's not too happy when you have to pay the toll and interact with the people on the road trip. This is what Matthew has experienced mostly all his life. And Jesus walks across the room and notices him. Jesus says to him, "Follow me." And Matthew got up and followed him. Luke says it this way, that Matthew dropped everything, left the booth, and followed Jesus. And it makes me ask this question, why would Matthew just drop everything? Why would he drop everything to follow this teacher who took notice of him? Well, you see, Matthew was a Jewish person, is a Jewish person. He was on the other side, so to speak, because he was extorting from the Jews. But like all good Jews in that day, they knew their history. They knew the Torah. They knew the story, the oral tradition. They knew God's promises for the nation of Israel. And Matthew, like so many others in Galilee, had to have observed all that Jesus was doing. He wasn't following him yet, but he had to have taken notice. And if you know the story of Israel, you know that God made a promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that this land would be theirs and it would be full of great blessing. And then God continues to make promises to Moses and to David that David's kingdom would reign on earth forever, that a Messiah would come from David's kingdom. And then David's kingdom, as it was passed down to generations, is split between north and south. You see, Matthew would have known this story. His real name, his biblical name, his Jewish name was Levi. He would have known the tradition. He would have known the story. And he would have known that 700 years before, there was a king named Ahaz that didn't follow the advice of a prophet named Isaiah. You see, God would send messengers or prophets to the kings to give them wisdom about how to interact. And Israel was under attack, the northern tribes from the Assyrian Empire. You see, the Bible isn't just theology and doctrine, it's a book of history as well. And it lines up with world history. And the Syrian Empire was a sister city to Babylon. They're two Mesopotamian states, but Assyrian led with war. Babylon led with culture. But in this day, in Ahaz's day, 700 years before Matthew is sitting in that tax collector's booth, Assyria is moving in on the northern tribes. Isaiah the prophet gives Ahaz wisdom. Ahaz ignores it. And ultimately, the entire northern tribes from this area of Israel, right around the Galilee, get deported to Assyria. You see, they were conquered and deported. Isaiah spoke often to the curse that would come to those in Israel that didn't follow God's voice. But check out the promise Isaiah gives, even in the midst of deportation. It's found in Isaiah chapter 9. I'm going to read it because I think it's fascinating. And Matthew would have known that this was in the history of this area of Israel. It says this, Isaiah says, "Nevertheless," he's speaking to the reality of Assyrian conquest, of deportation, of raping and pillaging and violence that has happened to the nation of Israel. "But nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who are in distress." That's a promise. "In the past, God humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali." You see, in Isaiah's day, the land around the Sea of Galilee was known as Zebulun and Naphtali. "But in the future, God will honor Galilee of the Gentiles." Can you believe that? 700 years prior, Isaiah says, God will honor the Galilee of the Gentiles. He says, "The people walking in darkness will see a great light. Those living in the land of the shadow of death," this history of conquest and deportation, "a light will dawn. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy," he says of God. "They will rejoice before you, O God, as people rejoice at the harvest." Isaiah 9 goes on to say this. You've heard this before. Check this out. "For to us a child is born, a son is given. The government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. On the increase of his government and peace there will be no end, and he will reign on David's throne over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness." You see, Matthew, despite his job as an extortionist of his own people, he knew his history. He knew his Bible. He knew that there was a promise, despite the brokenness in his own life and in his land, that God made a promise. And here was this promise walking amongst the people. Jesus himself bringing light to darkness, healing to death, authority over the weather. You see, Matthew, here's the call of someone who took notice of him, and he gets up and leaves everything. I want to tell you what Jesus did. He walked across the room, and in doing so, he validated Matthew's existence. You see, so many of us, we need to know that Jesus loves us, that those promises he's made to us, that he'll make good on those, and he did that for Matthew, but often when he does that, we need to know that our existence is validated, that there's a reason for us to be here, that there's a purpose in our life. You see, Matthew was in a dead-end job. Some of us get frustrated with the job we find ourselves in. We get frustrated that we don't have a job. We get frustrated with the brokenness in our family or those around us. And Jesus reaches out, walks across the room, and validates his existence. I would also say to us, our neighbors, our coworkers, who know that this Jesus thing is happening in our country, it's not foreign that people follow Jesus. Just like to Matthew, he knew this Jesus thing was happening around the Galilee. He just needed someone to walk across the room and invite him and validate his existence. You see, your neighbors are watching you. They're observing you. They're trying to see what Jesus is like through you. And you may be the only representation to Jesus that they ever have. And when you walk across the room, the street, the neighborhood, the cubicle, when you walk across the room, it validates their existence from someone who knows the God of all creation. What Jesus does here is he simply walks across the room. You see, walking across the room can be a scary proposition at times, it goes on to say this: while Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him. Luke records it this way. He says, when Levi or Matthew held a great banquet, Levi throws a party, and a large crowd of tax collectors and others were eating with them. Not just a crowd, but Luke points out a large crowd. So Jesus is walking across the room, draws him into a large crowd of people who are very different from him. Tax collectors, sinners. You know, when you work middle management extortionism, you've got lots of friends that do the same thing, and you know how to party. You see, my grandfather grew up in North Denver. My mother grew up in North Denver. And if you know the history of North Denver, it used to be run by the Italian mafia. The Italian mob was kind of like a mini Chicago in North Denver here. And my grandmother can still take me to the areas where the mob used to gather and party. She could say they'd hang out in that restaurant. You'd see so-and-so and so-and-so, and I won't name any names because they might be some of my cousins. But you could find where they hung out because they hung out. They partied. They gathered. When they had something to celebrate, they'd call each other. This is what Matthew does. He calls his friends and says, this hope to our land, this hope of what God promised 700 years ago, he spoke to me at my tax collector's booth, and it's worthy of you coming and hearing him and meeting him. You see, when you follow what Jesus has done, he walked across the room, and he crossed into an area that was uncomfortable. He crossed into an area and dined with those who were different. You see, the Pharisees, they didn't like this so much. It goes on to say this: when the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" To the Pharisees, anyone who didn't follow the law was unclean and unworthy of being around. And to dine with someone, to banquet, to party, to eat, meant to be in friendship. And Jesus demonstrates to all of us and to his disciples and to the Pharisees, these people that are different than us, that don't understand our ways yet, they're worthy of friendship. He validates their existence by dining with them. Jesus hears these questions from the Pharisees who were there, and he says this: it is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. But Pharisees, go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, for I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners. You see, he quotes the prophet Hosea, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. It's this idea that God, he appreciates when we worship. He appreciates when we come to church. He wants to live he wants us to live our lives in a way that honors him. He wants that sacrifice, but he wants mercy more than he wants sacrifice. He wants us to get out of our holier-than-thou mentality that we do these things and we study the Bible and we come to church Sundays, and he wants us to reach across the room in mercy to those who are different than us. He wants us to go across the room and reach out. You see, if you unpack theologically what Hosea is saying, and I desire mercy over sacrifice, you can see that some theologians would argue that God desires friendship. He desires friendship with us, but he desires us to have friendship with others. Jesus says to the Pharisees, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. What does that look like for us today? What does it look like for us to walk across the room when it's scary? What does it look like for us to reach to the hurting across the street from us, in the cube next to us, at the gym, at the grocery store? Well, it's a little bit cheesy, but I'm going to have you write it down. It means be willing to enter the zone of the unknown. Be willing to enter the zone of the unknown. You see, in the last year, I've got to hang out a little bit with one of our elders and a bunch of our elders, but one of them in particular, who I've always from afar had a great reverence for, has just blown me away with how he leads his life. Because how he leads his life as he's followed God, he takes these scriptures literal, as we all should, and he puts them into practice in his life and the life of his family and the life of his children. His name's Michael Hegarty. And if you saw him from afar, you would be able to discern he's a conservative person and loves Scripture and wants to live it out every day and wants to see it lived out in his family. But you can discern that from afar. And if you know him, you would know he's one of the most conservative persons in our church, and he's one of our elders and has been for years. But what I've seen in Michael the last year, I've got to watch him and observe him and hear from others, is in Sunday school class or in the atrium or in the community or at the gym, I've seen him at the Apex Center running, and he's talking to someone who looks, behaves, and believes entirely different than him. When a new family that maybe doesn't look like they should when they walk into church, not that there's a way you should, but you all know what I mean. They might be tattooed or pierced and they're new to this thing called church. He'll be the first one to walk across the room and say hi to him. You see, Michael's mastered the discipline of entering the zone of the unknown. I've seen him chat with people on the treadmill who do not know that he's an elder in a church, but he's befriending them so that he can validate their existence, so that he can minister to him. That's what Jesus tells us to do, to walk across the room and enter the zone of the unknown. I read this statistic a few weeks back that was really scary and sad, and it said that almost every Christian, after 5 years of becoming a Christian, has no real relationship with an unsaved person. You see, it's good for us to find family in church. There's no doubt about it. It's good for us to find community of people who believe the same things and who are like-minded. I celebrate that. We have all sorts of ways to do that in this church, and it's a big part of who we are. But to the extent that we put ourselves into a bubble and miss on the ability to be in that zone of the unknown, we're missing what Jesus actually did with his life. The second step that Jesus shows us often in his life as he encounters people is to follow the Spirit's prompting. To follow the Spirit's prompting. Now, I'm not asking you to go make friends and go partying with everyone who lives differently than you. For some of us, that would be a danger to some of the ways we've been healed from addiction. But I'm asking you to follow the Spirit's prompting when he's encouraging you to go talk to your neighbor. When you see and discern that your coworker is having a rough day, would you just have the courage to go and share with them that you care for them and you have compassion for them? Would you be Jesus to them and validate their existence and their struggle? I want to give you two practical opportunities as well. We could just talk about it, but if we didn't give you a chance to do it, we'd be missing the mark. So I'm going to ask you to pull out your Easter ticket from what was handed to you on the way in. In 2 weeks, the Easter play begins on Palm Sunday evening. And I want to say something cautiously, but a little bit strongly. Let's be careful not to think, well, we've seen the Easter play for 12 years, and we've seen it all before. And you know what? Last year, that cross scene, it wasn't as powerful as that cross scene they used to do. Or that miracle scene, what was that? I didn't understand what was happening. It wasn't as clear as it's been in past years. And I'm challenging you because I'm challenging me, because we can all come knowing the story and critique a production. Well, Pastor George would be the first to say, we don't produce this to be a performing arts that could show at the Denver Center. We do this because there are lost and hurting in our community that have never heard the real story of a God of all creation who loves them even right where they're at. And so what I'm asking you to do is walk across the room. You've got two tickets in your brochure, and I would tell you to go out in the atrium to get more, but the 1,000 we had are already gone, so there'll be more next weekend. So hold on to these two and use them this week. Enter the zone of the unknown. Follow the Spirit's prompting. Invite someone to come to Easter and hear the story of Jesus reaching out for salvation. If you're really brave and you want to go a step further, go ahead and pull out the yellow slip in your handouts as well. It's called Outreach Encounter. We've got a man in our church who loves to reach out to the community like Jesus does, following the Spirit's prompting. And if you were to ask him 5 years ago if he'd ever see himself doing this, he'd say, no way. But God has led him to do this. And on Saturdays, for the next 3 weekends, he's going to ask for a group of people, however many want to come join him. And what it looks like is you gather and you pray. And you ask God to give you clues about who might be on God's heart tonight. And you write them down, and you write locations down, and, you know, apparel, and just clues of what God's leading you to. And you all pray as a group, and you share your clues, and then you go out into the Arvada area. And God leads you, and this happens every time for them. God will lead you to a person that matches those clues. And every time it happens, they walk up to someone and say, hey, we've been walking around the city praying for people, And God led us to pray for you. They don't get all weird and tell them all the clues and all the things that led them there, but they say, is there anything we could pray for? And to a person, that person says, I was just saying to God, who I don't even know if I believe in, that if you could just show me a sign, I'm going to make it through this divorce, or I'm going to make it through this job loss, or I'm going to have food for the kids. Every time this person responds by saying, that's exactly what I needed today. And they pray and minister, and once in a while when they feel led, they say, you know, God in particular wanted to speak to you because an hour ago he gave us these clues, and they point out the color of their jacket, or they point out the type of shoes that they had on that God led them to an hour ago. You see, Scott's in the atrium today. He's got a table, and he'd love to meet you and invite you to do that. So if you've got a lot of courage or even some trepidation, why don't you go out and do this? Walk across the room, enter the zone of the unknown, and follow the Spirit's prompting. So what happens in the life of Matthew after this encounter? What happens in the life of Jesus after this encounter? Well, Jesus continues to minister through the villages and the towns. And then he says this to his disciples. It's one of Jesus' prayers for himself, for his disciples, and therefore also us. He says this, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers in his harvest field. And we celebrate missions, and we're going to celebrate that in a few moments, and we're going to ask you to be a part of that. And sometimes we think those are the workers we've sent out. And our missionary partners, they see themselves as this. They're going to the harvest field to do the work of the ministry. But Jesus says this to all of his disciples, not just those called to be missionaries. He says, do the work of the harvest. He has compassion on the people when he sees the crowd, and he prays and asks his disciples to get a heart for being part of the harvest. We want you to be part of the harvest. He continues on. He ultimately goes to his death on a cross and his resurrection. He comes back in his last days after the resurrection. He speaks once again to the disciples, and he gives us this command. It's what we know as the Great Commission. Jesus came to them and said this, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples in all nations. The original Greek says ethnos, or ethnicities. It applies to everyone who's different than you guys, you disciples. Go throughout the world and make disciples of every ethnicity, every demographic, everyone who's different from you. We've translated in English as nations, and therefore we do send missionaries to nations, but it's applicable right in our own city and the diversity and differences we find even with our neighbors and coworkers. He says, baptize them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, and teach them to obey everything I've commanded you. I'm with you always to the very end of the age. Meaning, I will guide you. I will prompt you. I'm with you. I will lead you into the unknown. You see, Jesus wants us to walk across the room and reach across the world. When Matthew gets a hold of this truth, he invites his friends to a banquet so that they can meet Jesus. But if you don't know the story, Matthew becomes one of the apostles, ultimately an evangelist. He's there when Jesus gives the Great Commission, and then he authors the Gospel of Matthew. Some of you study your Bible. You knew that Matthew the tax collector was later the author of the Gospel of Matthew, but some of you didn't. He changes the world by simply telling the story of Jesus' life. 2,000 years later, we're impacted when we read this story. Matthew follows God's command and tells the world about Jesus.
We hope that this message has spoken something personal to you. If you would like more information about our church family or service times, please call us at 303-424-2121 or visit us at our website, www.fbci.org. Faith Bible Chapel currently meets in our Family Worship Center, located on the corner of 62nd Avenue and Ward Road.